I'd like to convene the Ways and Means Committee, and on the agenda we have further down the line the approval of the minutes. We don't have a quorum present yet with the weather in certain parts of the state. I don't know if we'll have our usual good attendance or not, but we'll get started at any rate, and hopefully some more members will be able to join us shortly. First part of the hearing is devoted to the November forecast, and I think we all are aware there's been a fair amount of publicity as a result of the announcement yesterday. But with the role that the Ways and Means Committee plays, feel it's important that we have a presentation and an opportunity for members of the committee to ask any questions that they may have relative to the forecast. So, Commissioner Showalter, you're going to be the lead off, and maybe you could mention as you're leading off a slight change in terms of the agenda, in terms of who will be testifying.
You bet, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. And is that a little bit better? Is it coming through? We will present to you, as first part of your agenda, information that was released yesterday, which is the November revenue and economic forecast, giving you an updated set of budget numbers for the state. With me is State Budget Director Margaret Kelly, to my far right. Dr. Kalamakidis was anticipating being here today, but had a family emergency, is not able to be here. Regrets on that part, but we are fortunately joined by Matt Shepner, immediately to my right, and John Pelequin, who will join us in a little bit. And they have been very, very closely involved with this forecast and previous forecasts, and I think we can ably explain both the forecast and any questions that you might have regarding the revenue forecast. The documents that you have should include what is a one-page summary document, has a little stripe, I believe, across the top, called at a glance, as well as the slides that we will have distributed as well. We'll go through the slide deck that we provided yesterday. A much more detailed document is available online that provides a quick, about 7 or 8 page executive summary of what's in the forecast, along with many more pages of narrative about the Minnesota state economy, the national economy, the state budget changes, as well as lots of just specific data that you might be interested in. As that is a preamble, let's just start up, because this is obviously an important forecast. It's the first one for quite some time, since 1999, where we are in the first part of a biennium, and we will have successfully paid off our obligations, so that school shifts or other balance repayments are all taken care of. And we have a projection of some budgetary balance by the end of the biennium. That being said, it doesn't mean that this is all money in the bank. It is the case that this is a projection and a forecast of what's going to happen between now and June of 2015. As a result, we took some pains yesterday to point out the issues that are still ahead and the questions that are still there. That said, we are really happy with the progress that the state has made in restoring its fiscal house, the continued improvement in the state's economy and the jobs and activity that are really the story of this forecast improvement. And we'll try to explain how these things all interact in this presentation. The first chart that's up on your screen shows that there's an $825 million budget balance projected for 2014 and 15. The beginning balance of about $1.7 billion really is the starting point for this forecast. And if you recall, last legislative session, we were specifically instructed in law to take the end of biennium balances for 2013 and set those aside for repayment for school shifts. And so that beginning balance is swelled by that amount, I think it's like $636 million So you add that to the reserves. That's basically what you're looking at as the beginning point for this forecast. It's going to be important, and I point that out in part because that improvement in tax years 12, calendar year, fiscal year 13, is part of the calculation, part of what happened in to improve some of our revenue forecasts. When you look at the next couple of lines, what you'll see is that the revenues at a level of $39 billion is up $787 million from prior estimates, and spending is down $247 million. Some of the charts that you're going to see today, I should also note, are compared with, on the chart it says, from October estimates. The October estimate is a shorthand for three different things put together. End of session numbers, which is commonly what we would cite. But there was a short special session that also had some fiscal impact, some spending that was authorized at that point in time, plus that October or the end of September end of balance, end of a year balance that was supposed to be used for paying down the shifts. So those three pieces together form the starting point and the comparison point of what else has happened, what is the news in this forecast. So with that balance, the $1.086 billion of the forecast improvement was more than sufficient to pay back the remaining school shift buyback that wasn't paid back in October. That goes to the property tax recognition shift, as well as repay the airports fund, something that occurred in 2008. Bottom line, $825 million balance is left over on a projected basis for the fiscal biennium. What I'd like to do then is go to a brief discussion of the U.S. economy and that somewhat confusing connection between what's happening in the U.S. economy, which is slightly weaker than what was in the February forecast, and how that translates or doesn't translate into changes in the Minnesota economy, which has been performing quite well, and then ultimately the connection with Minnesota revenues, and obviously the variability and the changes in different types of tax types that yield the revenue increases that we're projecting here today. With that, I will turn it over to Matt Scheppner of our economic analysis staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Matt Scheppner. I'm an economist with Minnesota Management and Budget. Today I'm going to present largely what Dr. Kalambakidis would have been speaking to had she been here. I'm going to begin by presenting the U.S. economic outlook, move to some specifics about the Minnesota economy, and then turn it over to my colleague John Pelequin to discuss the revenue side of the forecast. We'll finish up a little bit at the end by talking about some of the forecast risks. The U.S. economy has continued to grow at a modest pace in 2013. You can see from this chart that Global Insight expects 1.7% growth in real GDP for 2013, despite the federal budget cuts known as sequestration and significant uncertainty created by federal policymakers' failure to agree on a fiscal 2014 budget, leading to the 16-day shutdown of much of the U.S. government in early October. Many macroeconomic forecasters, including Global Insight, which is Minnesota's macroeconomic consultant, agree that the additional federal fiscal restraint in the form of the sequestered spending, largely, and policy uncertainty have both taken a toll on consumer and business confidence this year. Lower confidence, in turn, has dampened spending, investment, and hiring in 2013. Consequently, the forecast for U.S. economic growth has slightly weakened since Minnesota's last forecast was prepared in February. Again, turning to this chart, the November baseline forecasts real GDP growth to accelerate from the 1.7% I mentioned for 2013 to 2.5% in 2014 and 3.1% in 2015. The February baseline forecast called for slightly stronger growth of 1.9% in 2013, followed by 2.8% in 2014 and 3.3% in 2015. The horizon for our planning estimates in 2016 and 2017, Global Insight has increased their growth expectations since February. In 2016, they're now expecting 3.3% real GDP growth, followed by 3.1% growth in 2017, compared to 2.9 and 2.8% in February. And it should also be noted that Global Insights November baseline forecasts for 2013 through 2016 is very similar to the blue chip consensus, which is the median of 50 business and academic forecasts throughout the country. Despite the slightly weaker outlook since February and short-term challenges that I discussed a little earlier, fundamentals for solid growth in the U.S. economy are indeed in place. One of the challenges has been the lingering federal fiscal policy uncertainty. The 11th-hour agreement that ended the federal shutdown funds the government through January 15th and suspends the debt limit until February 7th. It does not address the second round of sequestration cuts that are set to begin also on January 15th. The deal, therefore, creates another set of deadlines in early 2014 and prolongs uncertainty about short-term federal fiscal policy. But once short-term challenges, including those federal fiscal uncertainties, are behind us, Global Insight does expect growth to accelerate throughout 2014. That acceleration is expected to be led by an upturn in consumer spending, improved housing, and equipment investment. In addition to the easing of federal fiscal drag, recent positive, albeit preliminary, economic reports support this view. Real U.S. GDP growth in the third quarter of 2013 is now reported to be 3.6%. And it was just announced this morning that there was an additional 203,000 jobs created in November, following a similar report in October. Over 2013, the monthly average job creation has come in about 189,000. So the larger number is fairly new, and these monthly reports are often revised. In addition, the GDP number reflects a large increase in business inventories that offset slower growth in personal consumption and business investment, and that 3.6 number in the third quarter could also be revised. So, acceleration is expected in 2014, but risks and uncertainties remain. Global Insight believes the most significant near-term threats facing the U.S. economy are political uncertainty surrounding budget and debt ceiling discussions early next year, and possible revisions to those recent positive reports on GDP and employment at the national level. Now, even though we talk a lot about the U.S. economic situation, and it certainly does influence Minnesota's economy, growth in the state's revenues does not march lockstep with U.S. GDP growth. In fact, U.S. real GDP can grow moderately while state tax revenues grow fairly well. One example we have is that in 2012, nominal GDP rose 4.2% nationally, while Minnesota's tax collections were up about 12%. Before I get to the revenue story, though, let's talk a bit about the link between U.S. growth and revenues, which is the Minnesota economy. Switch it here. Minnesota's economy continues to make solid gains and in some ways is outperforming U.S. averages. The Bureau of Economic Analysis, for example, reports that state GDP in 2012 rose 3.5%, real GDP rose 3.5%, ranking among the six fastest state economies during that year. The state's unemployment rate has fallen to 4.8% in October, the lowest level since the recession began in December of 2007. And at least prior to this morning's employment report nationally, a full 2.5% percentage points lower than the nation. First-time claims for jobless benefits have fallen to levels not observed in more than a decade. Leading labor market indicators like temporary help employment, average hours worked, job vacancies, and the number of unemployed remain very strong. And preliminary income tax withholding collections during the first 10 months of this year, 2013, suggest that Minnesota's growth in wage and salary income is outperforming previous expectations that we'd made in February. On top of that, non-farm employment payrolls have increased by an average of 3,400 jobs each month during the first 10 months of 2013 in Minnesota. about the same modest pace as the last 2 years, and gains are occurring across every major industry with the exception of manufacturing and federal government employment. That broad-based economic revival has helped Minnesota recover from recession faster than the nation. As of August 2013, the state has now recovered all of the approximately 150,000 jobs lost during the recession. Nationally, about 82% of the 8 million jobs lost during the recession have come back. This chart plots our forecast and actual through October of this year for total Minnesota non-farm employment. You can see the pre-recession peak in 2008, and recent numbers illustrate the recovery back to that level. It also shows that our forecast is for steady, moderate growth in employment. Aggregates and averages can mask important differences among groups. I will talk quickly to two areas, manufacturing and construction. Minnesota manufacturers are still employing fewer people than they did before the recession, and even fewer than they did a year ago. The good news, though, is that after a tough spring and summer, manufacturing saw two solid months of growth this fall, and these jobs were in both durable and non-durable manufacturing. This uptick is also consistent with national trends, such as the Institute of Supply Management Manufacturing Index, that strongly suggests the sector is in an expansionary phase. I also mentioned that the housing sector is expected to be an important factor in U.S. economic growth next year, and that's true for Minnesota as well. Inventories of existing homes in the Twin Cities are very low. In fact, they're back down to inventories, haven't been this low since early 2003, and home prices are higher, although they've still only recovered about 50% of the loss that we experienced since the housing downturn began in 2006. These low inventories are improving demand for new home construction, leading us to increase our forecast for building permits. Construction employment, while growing, is still below its pre-recession peaks and isn't growing as robustly as we'd like. We'll be looking for employment in construction to pick up early next year as home builders work to meet that increasing demand for new homes. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague John Pelequin to talk about the revenues.
Maybe this would be a good place to see if there are any questions while what you just went over is relatively fresh in members' minds. Apparently not. We'll proceed.
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Pelequin. I'm a staff economist with Minnesota Management and Budget. Stronger employment and income growth in 2013 that Matt has already mentioned has contributed to forecast revenue. Tax revenues for fiscal year 2014 and 15 are projected to be $37.5 billion, $824 million, or 2.2%. more than the February estimate adjusted for law changes. Total revenue is expected to be up $787 million. That includes transfers and all other revenue. Higher income and corporate taxes are the source of 95% of the increase in tax revenue. The individual income tax showed the largest dollar amount increase over prior estimates, up $496 million, or 2.6%, followed by the corporate income tax, which increased $254 million, or 10.5%. The change in the income tax since February is primarily due to an increase in MMD's estimate of tax liability for tax year 12, the year on which the forecast is based, and increased growth projections for some underlying sources of income. We estimate final liability for tax year 2012 to have been $165 million more than we had forecast in February. Capital gains reported by Minnesota residents in 2012 are now assumed to have grown 94.6%. In our February forecast, we had growth of about 82.6%. Assumed growth in Minnesota business income was also raised, and because the outlook for proprietors' income that drives business income anticipates steady growth, most of the growth in business income is assumed to carry forward. But we think some of the growth was due to the acceleration from tax year 2013 and does not go forward. There was also raised estimates for 2012 of farm income, dividends, and taxable Social Security. Withholding collections so far in 2013 suggests that Minnesota's wage and salary income is outperforming previous expectations. This led to an increase in the wage and salary growth of 0.8 percentage points cumulatively between 2013 and 15. 2013 itself was up 2 percentage points. The increase in projected corporate tax revenue reflects increased expectations of corporate profits. Corporate receipts were $115.7 million above forecast at the close of fiscal year 2013. Global Insights forecast for corporate profits goes from a pretty flat forecast in February to a 4 to 4.5% increase per year in November. The expected change in sales tax on net is $64 million over the biennium. It's down slightly in fiscal year 14 and up somewhat in fiscal year 15 due to stronger taxable sales. To see the bigger picture of this revenue forecast, recall that we ended fiscal year 2013 on June 30th with revenues of $582 million more than forecast. So starting this forecast, we knew we had money had come in above expectation. $364 million of that was in the income tax. That amount informed our estimate for tax year 12 income tax liability that I'd mentioned previously. We also knew that tax year 12 revenue was likely high because some income was shifted into 2012 in anticipation of federal tax increases. So we did not assume that the entire amount was part of the base on which we built this forecast. Forecast revenue was higher in each fiscal year than was anticipated in February. Following the $582 million we know appeared at the close of fiscal year 2013, we're projecting $346 million over the February forecast for fiscal year 2014 and $441 million over the prior forecast in fiscal year 2015 for a total of $787 million. I want to talk about one of the revenue forecasting risks. More revenues coming from less predictable. More revenues coming from less predictable sources. This is the first forecast since the enactment of the new 9.85% bracket in Minnesota's income tax. This change introduces some challenges to forecasting income tax revenues. Income taxes paid through prescribed withholding are relatively predictable, but not totally predictable. In contrast, much of the tax on non-wage income, such as portfolio and business income, is paid through estimated tax or through discretionary additional withholding payments. These payments are difficult to predict because the income is more variable in wages than wages and salaries, and because taxpayers time their payments in response to safe harbor provisions in ways that are not easily foreseen. Because taxpayers are affected by the new tax rate report a higher share of income from non-wage sources, a larger share of total income tax receipts are now being collected through payment streams that are harder to forecast. Testimony.
Mr. Chair, if there were any other questions on this segment, we'd be happy to take
them.
That's
what I was about to ask, like we did with the last segment. Any questions at this point? Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And given the volatility in 12 with the federal, trying to avoid the federal tax increases and talking about this uncertainty of how the fourth tier and the new taxes enacted in the last legislative session, you know, being harder to predict. Is that a continuing thing, or will you get better at it, or is this just going to be an uncertainty that we should be get used to?
Once it becomes part of the base, the timing of the payment should be easier to forecast. But the overall tax structure would be a little more volatile, the more if capital gains are taxed at a higher rate than business income is. But the special problems of forecasting now also have to do with the timing of payments, which is uncertain when people will pay the tax increase.
And then just for clarification purposes, I don't serve on the tax committee, but this 110% safe haven is not, if a taxpayer is uncertain as far as what level they're going to have to pay, we allow them to say, okay, we'll pay us 110% of what you paid us last time, and we won't fine you if you're off and owe us more. Is that how this works? Or
that's correct. However, under the tax law change, for their first three payments, there's a safe harbor. In other words, they don't have to take any of the tax law change into account in their first three payments. And my understanding is their fourth payment due on January 15th, they only have to take the income earned in that quarter, which would probably be 25%, depending on the business. So there is a safe harbor for this, but some taxpayers may be paying in advance of that. And some taxpayers may pay the safe harbor even though their incomes may be less next year or the same, just because their accountant suggests play it safe and you won't have to worry. So it makes the estimated tax payments hard to predict. And that makes figuring out the refunds and final payments harder to predict, too.
Representative Holder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so what should we expect by the February forecast? What will you know, or how will you be better or not?
Well, we will have final withholding for the fourth quarter, which is a big quarter, and we hope that'll inform us. And we will also have the fourth quarter estimated tax payments. That may inform us or it may confuse us. In other words, if they're extremely large, we may wonder, did people pay all of their increased tax in the fourth quarter even though they did not have to? Or are incomes just substantially more than we had forecasted? We've had substantial income growth in 12, and we're trying to figure out what's going on for sure in 13.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions?
Okay.
Commissioner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. As you can tell, even in a pinch, the department has some really just amazing economists putting together and asking a lot of questions that underlie our economic and revenue forecast. We're going to turn now to look at the spending side of the equation. With me is Margaret Kelly to walk through the anticipated changes on expenditures.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to speak to the spending slide up on the screen here. We have total spending for fiscal years 14 and 15 at $38.8 billion in this forecast, which is $247 million lower than previous estimates, which is a relatively minor adjustment to such a large budget. K-12 education, very little change in this area of spending. It's just $10 million lower than previous estimates, and again, this is a very small change given the size of this budget, $16 billion on a biennial basis. There is very little change in the general education aid spending changes, just minor slight increase in pupil growth is being offset by some corrections made to the general education model from the end of the legislative session. Net changes there is less than $1 million. Categorical aid spending is also revised downward slightly, accounting for the $10 million reduction in spending up on the chart here. And this is driven primarily by a decrease in literacy incentive aid, which is based on third grade reading scores, and there was a drop in those scores. And this change is offset partially by an increase in CUPE comp spending from the City of Minneapolis entering into the program. Property tax aids and credits, $3 billion of spending in 2014-15 and a $70 million reduction in spending compared to previous forecasts. This is entirely driven by the property tax refund program. Smaller average refund values and lower program participation in fiscal year 13 is driving the reduction in spending in fiscal years 14 through 17. Income growth is likely outpacing property value growth, the income growth that our economists spoke to. Health and Human Services spending, the second largest area of spending in our budget, $11 billion in 14 and 15, showing a $117 million reduction compared to previous forecasts. It's a relatively minor adjustment again here based on the size of this budget. There's about a third of this change, or $41 million, is being driven by lower than anticipated participation in the Community Alternatives for Disabled Individuals waiver, the CADI waiver, along with a slightly smaller overall average cost per caseload. This waiver provides in-home services to individuals with disabilities who are living in the community, and it's intended to keep them living in the community to avoid more costly facility-based care. And so these changes in fiscal year 13 actuals are driving the spending forecast down for fiscal years 14, 15, 16, and 17. We are still seeing growth in this program. It's about a 3% reduction in the overall growth, but we're still seeing 12 to 16% growth in this program over the forecast time period. About a quarter of the reduction here in Health and Human Services, or $26 million, is due to reduction in the state's share of the Medicare Part D prescription drug program. Prior to the federal Medicare Part D prescription drug program, states were providing prescription drug coverage to individuals in Medicaid. With the Medicare prescription drug D program, the federal government asked states to participate in the cost of that program. It's referred to as the Part D clawback. And so we have been paying our share to the federal government as more and more participants are using generic drugs as opposed to brand name drugs. The cost for the program has gone down, and we're seeing our payment to the federal government reduced slightly in this forecast period. The balance of the reduction here in Health and Human Services, $50 million, is from recognizing for the first time in the forecast federal revenue resulting from federal waiver approval back in 2012 for an increased rate payment to governmentally owned hospitals. Debt service, a small area of the budget, has a $28 million reduction in spending compared to previous estimates. It's a little more spending reduction than we usually see, but there are many variables contributing to this change, including higher investment earnings on holdings in the fund, and payments higher than estimated loan repayments from other areas in the fund. About half of the all other spending reduction, half of the $21 million or $10 million, is a result of changes in our assumptions around the Vikings Stadium bond sale. And so we are assuming now the sale will occur in January as opposed to August, which was in the previous forecast, and that the first debt service payment will be a interest-only payment instead of a interest and principal payment. So overall, just a slight reduction, $247 million. But repaying all of our K-12 shift buybacks, $246 million to bring the property tax recognition shift down to 0%, and repaying the airports fund, $15 million borrowed back in 2008, actually increases our spending in 14 and 15. When you add those things to our $38.8 billion budget, it becomes a $39 billion budget. And the change in spending compared to previous estimates is just a $13 million change.
Okay, are there any questions? Representative David.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just looking at the executive summary on the front page there. It says there that all shifts are now paid back. Did we forget about the June accelerated tax shift? How are we accounting for that? Because I don't think the front page or the page one of the executive summary is correct.
Mr. Chair, Representative, happy to take that. The 16A, Minnesota Statute 16A, specify a list of statutory obligations of the state. We actually carry those on our books as basically obligations, and so that when a forecast surplus arises, the mechanism is there to repay those. To be true, there are other issues of payment timing, shifts. I think that list is going to keep on growing now that the 16A list has been repaid. Our statement was about the list of obligations that the legislature has very specifically said need to be repaid and that they are a commitment to the extent that the state has money in any given forecast.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Commissioner. Maybe we could talk offline sometime because I'd like to know exactly how many shifts are still on the books, because it makes it sound like there's no more shifts anywhere. There's all sorts of shifts. Mm-hmm. And the shift on June accelerated is about $300 million. And I'm not being critical of anybody paying it or not paying it. I just don't think that's an accurate statement on the executive summary, because there are other shifts out there brought to us by both parties. And I'd like to maybe sit down sometime and get some totals as to where that's at. But I just didn't feel like it was an accurate statement, because I'm reading that it says that the shifts are gone, and they're not gone. We still have shifts. It's just they're not 16A shifts.
Mr. Chair, a representative, and certainly two words that we also use in those comments are statutory repayment or the school shifts. And the school shifts are the shorthand words for the majority of the repayment, the vast majority of those repayments that were authorized in 16A.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner.
Representative Holdridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to get a little more information on the MNSURE and the public health programs, and it's my understanding that this forecast doesn't reflect any of the activity and its accuracy of the last 2 months, but rather just as the program was put into law. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, to an extent that's correct. So in making assumptions or forecasting MA spending, there are modifications made in our base forecast for those populations that were brought in under the Affordable Care Act, the MA expansion population. And there are also assumptions in our forecast about enrollment growth that would be driven by the individual mandate. And so while there were changes made to those costs based on cost of participation in the program, there were not changes made to the assumptions around enrollment growth based on any activity that occurred in MNSURE in recent months. And in part because what we have in MNSURE is too premature, and the timing of that information becoming informative and when we actually do our forecast, they didn't support each other. And so our forecast was done prior to information in MNSURE being available to make changes in our assumptions. We will look at that again in February and probably again in November of next year to understand how the implementation of the Affordable Care Act should be adjusted in our forecast assumptions.
So just to be clear, my understanding is that when this program was presented and dollars were in the form of a fiscal note were put together for the cost of implementing this health care policy, that the mix of those that would buy private plans or plans that may be eligible for federal tax credits versus those that would be at least eventually wholly supported by the Minnesota taxpayer, medical assistance, or publicly funded health care programs, that the mix between those two categories or pots would be fairly close to a 50-50. It's my understanding that thus far in these programs, only about 18% of the enrollees are actually in the non-public subsidized pool or pot, if you will. Do you have any feel or any knowledge as far as if that mix tilts so badly off of originally was projected. Do you have like a per enrollee cost, or how much more it's going to cost per 1,000 individuals? Or I mean, I'm very concerned. It was certainly, some would say, you know, that those that have to pay are going to wait later to sign up, but we're, you know, we're to December 1st and still have less than 20% of those not relying on the taxpayer for the costs, or at least a portion of cost to their health care. And what kind of risk does that put, unknown risk, moving forward? If you could comment.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, there have been some adjustments made to the MA expansion population in the forecast based on our actual experience to date. And so you may recall we have we first included those individuals in our forecast back in 2011 when the governor, through executive order, added them to the program, and also did a fiscal note in last legislative session based on including them in law. And so we have some experience with that population and how they are actually coming on to the program compared to what we have thought, and have done some downward adjustments in several forecasts for that population. Your statistics regarding Minsure, to the extent that those end up being where things are at, there will be adjustment. You know, we'll make adjustments to the total MA population based on our assumptions of how many people will enroll due to the individual mandate when we start to see some actual enrollment statistics that can inform that decision. I do. I would say there probably is some downward risk in this forecast, and I can't speak to the Minsure statistics. I don't know, maybe Commissioner Showalter can, but we could provide you the average enrollee cost for MA.
Commissioner, do you have any
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think we would have to follow up on the, sort of the per enrollee cost. I would just only add, I think observation is quite right, Representative, that you know, the enrollment is uncertain yet, and I think that's where December is going to be just a very interesting month, that despite the public attention of turning on the exchanges on October 1, the assumption all along was that individuals seeking private insurance would be seeking insurance closer to January 1 when they'd start to benefit from the insurance they were about to put out money for. That is just happening now. And so I think that will make, I think, the February forecast in this question a lot more interesting.
And if I might, this might be a question for Chair Huntley. My recollection was is that there was federal subsidy for a certain period of time on the MA expansion, but that eventually the state would carry the cost. Can you do you remember where the cutoff dates and to what degree the state liability in those programs grows or not?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, I'm trying to recall the exact dates, which I probably can't do, but right now the feds are, for the MA expansion, are paying 100%. And for that's up to 138% of poverty. I think it, let me, I think I might have a piece of paper here that I believe in 2016 we have to start, 2017 is when we start paying 5% of the cost. And that part is correct. Whether that 5%, ultimately I think the law says 10% is the max that the states are going to pay.
Alrighty, thank you.
Representative Dabney, before you ask your question, would you care to make a motion to approve the minutes for the May 14th and September 9th?
I'd be thrilled to so move.
Okay, motion is before us. We've had a quorum for some time. It just was waiting for an opportunity to make a motion. Any discussion about the minutes? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Dabney, you did have a question.
I did, Mr. Chair, but you know, there's no free lunch and there's no free question. So thank you very much.
You just paid the entrance fee.
Exactly. Commissioner, talking about repayments here, you'll recall that the part of the conclusion to the 2011 government shutdown was the state borrowing $750 million and doing the first in our history deficit borrowing simply to pay our bills rather than either cutting to match our expenses to revenues or increasing revenues to match our revenues to our spending. I think it's projected to be over $1 billion in repayment over, I think it's 20 years. I guess I'm wondering, does this projection include repaying that deficit borrowing? If not, why not? Can you clarify for me, am I right about the 20 years that we would be saddled with paying that borrowing back if we're not able to resolve it at this time?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the question circles around the tobacco appropriation bonds or revenue bonds. At that time, bonds were authorized, and after clarification in the courts whether an appropriation bond was appropriate, we called the basically were able to refinance and issue appropriation bonds that would be paid off over time. The repayment of those bonds on an annual basis is included in this forecast. The call of those bonds in one fell swoop is not included in this forecast. For a couple of reasons. One, the repayment isn't part of a statutory trigger mechanism that we have in statute right now. And two, there isn't a similar call provision in those bonds. We already did call them once to basically be able to refinance them, saving taxpayer money at that time, but we don't have another similar provision to recall them. So a long answer to your question is, no, that part of state obligations is not cannot be advanced in this forecast.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Showalter, can you tell me where in the summary here or in the entire report, where would I find how you guys track the hole that we have in the Healthcare Access Fund right now? We're about $332 million in the hole for the Healthcare Access Fund. Where would I find that in the budget documents that you have here?
Sure.
Commissioner Schultz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, good question. The question is around Healthcare Access Fund. The forecast documents that you have in front of you, as they always have, really focus on the general fund. It's a question of the non-dedicated revenues coming in, mostly income tax, sales tax, and the appropriations that go out from that. The Healthcare Access Fund hasn't been included in this narrative, isn't in the document, so you're not going to find a discussion of that. As we discussed in the legislative briefings, there is a deficit in the 16 and 17 biennium in the Healthcare Access Fund. We do have a separate fund balance and brief narrative of that available on our website. And that information is available there. Similar information on other funds is put together in something we call the consolidated fund statement. Staff is working on that, and we will be getting that together. And typically that lags the general fund forecast by a week or two.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, maybe Mr. Marks can help me. Can you tell me what happens when there is a hole in the Healthcare Access Fund? We've got $332 million hole there now. How do we fill it? Does that come from the general fund? How does that work, or what happens in that situation?
Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the deficit in the Healthcare Access Fund is in fiscal 16 and 17, so it's not in the current biennium, so it's not an immediate problem. It would become an issue for the 2015 legislature as to how to deal with that. So there'd be the options would be getting more revenue in or reducing the spending in that fund. I believe there is language in law, if nothing would be done, I believe there's language directing the Commissioner of Human Services to reduce expenditures or essentially reduce the number of people benefiting from the fund. But as I say, it's not an immediate issue because it's not for the current biennium. It would it would have to be dealt with by the 2015 legislature if it's not dealt with before then.
And Mr. Chair, one last follow-up question for Mr. Marks. Out of this last legislative cycle, how much do we take out of the health care access fund as part of the budget balancing for this last session here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't recall the exact numbers. We are paying for more for essentially some of the expansion of medical assistance out of the health care access fund. Mr. Berg, the fiscal analyst for Health and Human Services, is in the room. He might be able to respond to that.
Mr. Berg, maybe you should go up to the front table if you're able to respond.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Doug Berg. I'm a fiscal analyst for Human Services. And if I can find the fund balance that Commissioner Showalter was just referring to, I don't know that number off the top of my head, but we paid for the expansion, the 2013 expansion of MA is costing the fund $21.3 million in 14 and 30 rounded $40 million in fiscal 15. Now there's two expansions, and then there's a 16 and 17 costs that I won't go into. So, but those are, I mean, again, as Mr. Mark said, those are in law paid directly for MA costs. They aren't simply a transfer into the general fund. They are a payment for MA specific costs, if that answers your question.
Representative Huntley?
Just a comment. It's that 330, 362, whatever it is, the shortage in the out biennium in the healthcare access fund is primarily due to the fact that our insurance rates in Minnesota in MenSure are much lower. We have the lowest insurance rates in the country in that fund. And that was not anticipated when they did the February forecast. They thought we would have more average kind of premiums. And when we set up what's called, well, it's still Minnesota Care for most of you, that's for people now that are between, or starting in 2014, people that are between 138% of poverty and 200% of poverty. And the feds would pay us in the out biennium for that group of people essentially 95% of what they would cost if they were in the regular exchange product. Okay. Well, it turns out that our Commerce Department was so effective in negotiating with the health insurance companies that the amount of money we're going to get in the out biennium is not nearly as much as we had thought. So there is, and that's where most of that shortage in the out biennium comes from, and we'll just have to deal with that next year.
Okay. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Huntley's comments on us having the lowest rates in the country, that may be true except in the southeast, where we're at least double any other part of the state in our costs for Obamacare rates.
Okay, any other questions? I've got one. I'd like to go back to one of the two gentlemen who testified. I'm not sure which one, but the manufacturing was referenced. And the question I have is based, I'm one that I follow the news stories and so on relative to business fairly faithfully. And they were talking about the fact that production in the manufacturing sector was quite high, but purchasing was lagging behind, and what that would mean for the next quarter. Do we build that into the model at all, or is that something that's just too new to have been given any consideration? In other words, I'm talking about the inventories that are on hand and are continuing to build with sales lagging?
Yeah, that is built in. It will be offset in the fourth quarter. So right now in the fourth quarter, Global Insight, I believe, is something less than 2%. So there are some short-term drags, both as a result of the federal government shutdown and the offsetting payback for the inventory accumulation in the third quarter. However, manufacturing overall is expected to start to pick up as global growth, for the most part, begins to strengthen, and we'll see that both nationally and in Minnesota, particularly housing-related manufacturing, we expect to be quite strong in 2014.
Okay, I guess you anticipated a couple of additional questions I had, and one, when you were referencing housing earlier, I recalled earlier today a meeting that former Representative Solberg and I had with Dr. Stinson before the Great Recession, and he brought up housing and said that there were some real clouds on the horizon. And essentially my question is, today it seems to be coming back, but how important is housing to the Minnesota economy?
It's the piece that I begin with, really. It's I think what you're probably referring to is between about 2002 and 2006, housing starts, or they're measured by permits in Minnesota, far outpaced what we would consider to be underlying demand, which is just general household formation, by quite a substantial margin. And so we were able to actually measure, get a general estimate of what we believe to be the excess housing going into the recession. Now, during the recession, housing was collapsing at the same time the formations were also very little and had fallen to almost zero for a year or two, which was pretty comparable to what had happened during the 1981-82 recessionary period. And so as we started to pull out during the recovery, formations started to come back, and the permits remained pretty low for about 4 or 5 years. I believe in 2012 we were up to about 15,000 permits, which was about, I don't have the number offhand, but I want to say like a 30 or 40% increase over the year before, but still about half of what they were prior to the recession. But as formations start to pick up, which whether it be the doubling up that occurred during the recession, some of that starts to loosen up, and people start moving out into their own homes, you start to see that excess that we measured prior to the recession worked off slowly. And so at the moment, over at least the last couple of years, we're pretty confident that formations have outpaced that underlying demand as permitting has been really low. And in fact, right now we estimate that sometime in 2013, that intersection occurred again, where we have indeed worked off that excess housing that occurred at the beginning of the last decade, and now that's one of the underlying drivers of our forecast moving forward for permitting.
Okay, are we seeing in the with that increase in permitting and construction and so on, the various support industries improving as well, timber industry and so on? We talked to Dr. Stinson. We talked not only about housing at the time, but also, and it might have been the presence of Representative Solberg because of his northern Minnesota roots, but part of the discussion was on the various support industries as well. And are they coming back? And, of course, they're a national supplier when you start talking about timber and so on.
Mm-hmm. For a long time, we did have the wood products manufacturing sector, which is predominantly in the northern part of the state, coming back quite gusto with the construction rebound. Now, given some of the sell-off of the OSB plants, et cetera, it's really unclear how much of that is going to come back. I think in this forecast we do have some recovery there, in the northern part of the state. I don't believe that that's industry, at least in this near term forecast, recovers what it lost during the recession. But there is some growth.
Okay. Any other questions? We do have another item on the agenda we should get to as well. Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just real briefly, if you could comment just in general terms about trends about recession and any current trends or feedback around recession outlook on the horizon for the state or country.
Yeah. We're coming up on 4 years of recovery here, so an expansion. So at some point or another, there's going to be another recession. And if you just look at the average business cycle, we would expect there to possibly be a recession even in the current forecast horizon with the planning estimates. Now, economists don't generally forecast inflection points like that until they near. But it, based on the averages in the past, average business cycles would suggest that that it's possible that during this planning cycle, at least in the planning estimates, that there may be another recession.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, I'd add, that was one of the discussion points, as the representative well knows, at the Council of Economic Advisors, of is there a possibility of recession? How do you sort of help people understand that there's risk, particularly when you look at a four-year planning horizon?
Okay. Any other questions before we leave the forecast? And okay, Commissioner, I want to thank your staff for their help with the presentation. And Commissioner, I think you're up next for the next topic.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I will turn it over to Budget Director Kelly to talk a little bit about the BPAS project.
I had the name Michelle Weber here. Is that?
Mr. Chair, Margaret Kelly, Budget Director, standing in as best I can for Michelle Weber, who is actually our project manager for our BPAS systems. You've seen her before at this committee. She was not able to attend today. I'm providing her presentation. And I have with me in the audience up here Lisa DeRamy and Christy Swanson, who are our project managers for the budget system project and the fiscal note system project, who are serving as my first calls for help.
My previous thank you still stands, but welcome back.
Okay. Thank you.
Before the committee.
So I am going to give you today an update on our three system projects that you provided funding for last legislative session. $4.5 million of funding to continue replacing our budget planning and analysis system, which we refer to as BPAS, to provide us with a new fiscal note tracking system, $1 million for that, and $1.4 million for a new capital budget system. So first I want to speak to how we are managing the projects and how we are involving state agencies and legislative staff in the design and implementation decision-making process. And while MMB is responsible for the systems, we fully recognize that we are not the day-to-day users of the systems, and we are trying to involve our customers as much as possible in system development and system testing. We have modified our oversight structure compared to our first phase of the BPAS project to embed agency and legislative staff more fully into the decision-making process. Rather than simply providing them updates and asking for feedback, we have given them seats at the table. And your staff and agency staff are participating in the system requirements setting, in the system design and scope setting, along with the system testing. So you can see here we have three project teams that are doing the management, the development, and the implementation on a day-to-day basis. And that oversight consists of both MMB and Minute and agency and legislative staff. We have a steering committee, kind of the middle area, who are providing ongoing project oversight. And that includes myself along with the project directors, staff from Minute and lead House and Senate fiscal staff and a representation from several agencies. And we have a final decision-making body, the Executive Committee, which is primarily the Commissioner of MMB and Commissioner of Minute, along with myself and our CIO. And while we have included specific staff on project teams, we're doing as much as we can also to reach out to a broader audience, both agency and legislative audience as well, via monthly updates with the newsletter and with regular stakeholder feedback sessions. So I'm going to speak for a few minutes.
Chair is violating his own rule here. I've got. My wife had surgery this morning, and I put her phone in my pocket, and I can't find what pocket I put it in. It'll quit eventually. By the way, the surgery went well.
But that's great to hear, Mr. Chair.
She has a new knee. And the one that's calling is my daughter that probably doesn't realize where her father is right now. She lives in Kentucky. There she goes. Jean, could you take over the committee for a minute? I better. She wants to know how her mom did at surgery.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to continue to talk for a minute about our BPAD project and speak to what we did in the first phase of the project. We went live in August of 2012, putting together a new biennial budget production process. We streamlined two separate technical systems into one system. We have nearly 300 users accessing that system, and we did it with a commercial off-the-shelf software product called Oracle Hyperion Public Sector Planning and Budgeting.
Ms. Kelly, excuse me. We've got one member, Representative Holberg. You have a question?
Thank you. Yeah, Mr. Chair, back to the previous slide, the all system users receive monthly newsletters. Is that already in active phase? Are you sending out newsletters, and are you viewing legislators as users of this? I'm just wondering if it's something that's past my desk that I've missed, or
Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, we are sending out monthly newsletters, and I'm not sure what it takes to get on the list.
Somebody is.
And I'm certainly,
Representative Holberg.
It's also very likely I could have missed it given the volume of things that we have sent to us.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, everyone who has a login ID is currently on the newsletter distribution list. We are more than happy to open it up to others if you'd like us to add members.
Representative Holberg.
All right, and certainly I can talk to you offline about that later. And then can you just back us up just a little bit? How does this integrate or line up with the SWIFT program? Are these two completely separate projects? Is this a phase? I'm much more familiar with SWIFT than I am this project.
Ms. Kelly.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Representative Holberg, SWIFT is our statewide accounting system, so it's what's used on a day-to-day basis by agencies to manage all of their financial transactions. BPAS, or our budget planning and analysis system, is used solely for building the biennial budget, for tracking the legislative changes, and eventually we will use it to upload adopted budget information into SWIFT. And so it really is a planning tool that is used outside of the accounting system to make the budget adjustments that we put forward in the form of a budget document every other year.
All right, thank you. Right.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question for Ms. Kelly, or maybe it's for Mr. Showalter, but you know we're involved with the Legislative Audit Commission, and one of the statutory requirements of the legislative auditor is to actually audit or look at the books of the state once a year. I think there's a deadline comes up in January. It has to be done by. We've had a considerable difficulty this past year getting that done. Is that because of the changes that are happening with the installation of this program? I guess that's my first question, and then Mr. Chair might have a follow-up question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, we did have difficulty getting our CAFR report, which is our Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, mm-hmm. completed on time last year, mm-hmm. And that is not tied to our budget system, but it is tied to SWIFT, our accounting system. We are on track to deliver that on time this year.
Mr. Chair, thank you. That was my follow-up question. Do we anticipate this year we should be able to operate smoothly and get those reports out on time? And
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we do.
Kelly.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Baymer.
Thank you. So the is it your organization then is responsible for designing the budget books that the legislature gets?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, yes, it is. We are responsible for the budget books, and we are in the process now of taking a look at what we've done in the past, the most recent past, and the further past, and taking into consideration all the feedback we've gotten based on the recent document. And we will propose some revisions to that document for the next biennial budget and come and speak with you in advance of putting those templates together.
Mr. Chair, and if I could ask you, phase one improvements, the stakeholder feedback. I haven't been asked for any feedback, and I can tell you as one fiscal chair, I think those budget books were absolutely atrocious. It was 10 steps backwards from what we used to have in terms of our committee having any understanding of what's going on with the divisions under the auspices of our committee. And so I don't know what feedback you're looking for, but I could just say start over. There's nothing in those budget books. I don't know. I can't believe that those were given to us.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we heard your feedback loud and clear. We are preparing modifications to the document for the next biennial budget process. We're happy to sit down and review those when we're ready. There is requirement in law that we deliver to you all the templates that we're going to use. That requirement, I believe, is in June of each year preceding it. And we probably will come and meet with you prior to that so that we can deliver final templates by that time.
Thank you.
So I was one that got a fair amount of feedback on that particular question or discussion last session. So I was part of the feedback, I think, or I know. And can we count on the fact that there will be more good and valid information in the books as they come forward?
Mr. Chair?
I think that's kind of the bottom line question, as we move forward. You've got that feedback, so can we count on more information being available?
Mr. Chair, that's our goal.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
That's our goal.
That's the goal. Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I might, for just kind of piggybacking off a little bit of Representative Paymar, so when you come with these templates in June, are we going to be at a place where it's too late to change them? Or, I mean, so many times when projects, they get so far down the line, and if it doesn't worry, have issues or need changes, then we get a fiscal note associated. And if you're developing a system, is this system able to flex enough to reflect any changes or feedback that you may get in June or prior to June?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, that's a very valid question, and I think what we're going to try and do is to come to you twice, so once prior to the June deadline to hear what you have to say, and then once with revisions to that with our June deadline. But given the June deadline, there will still be time to make revisions after that. We typically send out instructions to agencies sometime in August or September in preparation for a biennial budget that's delivered to you all by the following January. So, or a biennial budget that's delivered to you all by the following January. So, our goal would be that we leave enough time for that process. So.
All right, thank you.
Hey, Ms. Kelly?
Right, so I'm going to move on to phase one improvements. So since the end of session, we've continued to work on our phase one of the budget system progress to make substantial improvements to the system itself. We first worked with MAD, Management Analysis Division at MMB, to survey stakeholders to identify what changes users wanted to see. And on this slide, you can see a list of the improvements we've made or are working on making that will significantly improve the usability of the system and help fiscal analysts and agency staff have greater confidence in the reports that they're running out of the system. And I would add here that much of the discussion we have just had about the document itself is not driven by the system. What's driven by the system is the reporting that comes out of the data that's built into it. So the fiscal pages within the document itself. We were challenged with the last biennial budget in that we have off-the-shelf software, and there are limitations with that software in terms of how we present data. And so that was some of your frustrations were driven by the limitations that we had. We have worked quite a bit with our with contractors who are familiar with this software package to make modifications in how we have designed the system and put the data into the system to give greater flexibility in pulling information out, and hope to have better reports that are easier to access for fiscal staff in the coming biennial budget. So the next phases, phase two and three of our budget system process, are beginning. When these phases are complete, you can see here the components of these budget phases. When they are complete, we will have a budget system that will be able to download financial information from our statewide accounting system. It will allow agencies to model different staffing and budgeting scenarios within that data and put together recommendations that would come to you in the governor's budget document. It will allow legislative staff to access agency budget information, and it will allow MMB to develop a biennial and a supplemental process, a budget document. And once the budgets are adopted, it will allow MMB to load that information back into our accounting system and to publish an adopted budget. And that would be something we would be able to do for the first time, is to publish an adopted budget. And we hope to accomplish all of that by the end of this biennium.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you just said that it would allow the governor's office access to the department budgets. Did I hear that correctly?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, what the system will allow is for agencies to, which is what the current system does, agencies put their recommendations, we put it all into a system so that we can create reports to process decision making with the governor. And this system will replicate that that process that we currently have.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Mahoney.
To Representative Paymar's point and Representative Holberg's point, any chance that we'll be able to access that? Because frankly, I have to agree with both of my colleagues that it was relatively frustrating trying to figure out the budgetary document. So my question is, how far does that sharing go?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, the reporting that comes out of that is the same for the governor as it is for all of you. And so we will be improving the fiscal reporting that will be included in the budget document, and we will work with you to make sure we are portraying the information in the way you need it.
Okay, Ms. Kelly?
I'm going to move on to the fiscal note system unless there are more questions on the budget project.
Okay, and just real quick, I know that they're trying to find budget examples of fiscal notes, but in the handout where it says we'll have copies attached, they actually weren't included. I know this, first of all, I want to apologize because I know this isn't your project you're standing in today. But in reading one of the newsletters, it says that you're going to present these plans at our meeting today. So, number one, I'm hoping that you'll provide, I think we're going to get copies of these documents that we're supposed to be reviewing today. But it's a little cumbersome. It's 3:30 on a Friday. Maybe if we could find some way for
fiscal chairs and Ways and Means Committee members to all get copies of these drafts and a timeline and a process for feedback. That might feel a little more like an organized process for feedback, at least on those forms.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, my apologies. We sent the wrong PDF file, and I believe Bill Marks is making copies, or they are. Clearly it's not Bill, but the copies are being made. And we certainly will forward copies electronically to all of you and provide you a feedback for timeline. So thank you.
Okay.
So our fiscal notes system replacement project kicked off July 1st of this year. We have already detailed design documents. That work is substantially completed. Our initial system build is underway, and the system will go live in January of 2015, so not for this legislative session, but for the following legislative session. Our project scope is to maintain functionality that we have with the existing system, and we're hoping to make some improvements to it. And we're improving the security features to restrict access when we need to, for example, for unofficial fiscal notes. And on the next slide, based on user feedback, the security features will also allow agencies to use the system for their internal drafting and review, which will eliminate the need for standalone processes in agencies. We also have an opportunity to provide additional information in the fiscal note itself. Your staff has asked that the front page of the fiscal note identify where agencies are absorbing costs and if and when funds are being transferred between agencies or between funds. And so we are working with staff to accommodate those requests. And those examples are what we had intended to attach to this file for you to see what that would look like. The more information you put on the front page of a fiscal note, the more cluttered it becomes, and perhaps you're okay with that. We've provided you an example of all the information that we could put on the front page of a fiscal note, and then we've provided you with an example of summary information on the front page and all the detailed information on the second page. And so you can take a look at that. We took an existing fiscal note from the system and kind of mocked it up in two different ways. You can take a look at that, give feedback either to myself or to Bill Marks about which way you prefer or other changes you recommend. We are trying to accommodate as many opinions as we can. We won't be able to accommodate every opinion because oftentimes they're competing with each other. We are not the end users of fiscal notes. We recognize you are, and so we want to make them as useful to all of you as possible. So we still have plenty of time to make those changes.
Kind of from my perspective, two questions, you know, the content of the fiscal note and how it's structured. But one of my concerns over the years has been the turnaround time. And I'm not sure just how that's prioritized or planned to be prioritized internally, but I know when I chaired the old Finance Committee, we actually had to delay hearings sometimes because the division chairs couldn't get for the omnibus bill timely fiscal notes. And that becomes vitally important, and I suspect, you know, there has to be some way of prioritizing those requests when the omnibus bills are being put together so that the information made available to those committees is there in a timely manner. And we established those deadlines, you know, very early in the session. So just a little bit of feedback now, and we've talked about that before. Going back several years, what we could do to improve that turnaround time. And I know some of those bills are huge, and but that's where the priority, I think, has to be, because we have literally constitutional deadlines that we have to meet in getting these bills out. We've had less discussion about looking the tax committee chair there, the revenue notes. I don't know if they've had as many problems as we've had sometimes on the finance side in terms of a timeliness, but
Mr. Chair,
that's just a priority from my standpoint.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that comment. It's not something that can be solved with the new fiscal note system. It's more process, and I know that with the legislative audit report from 2 years ago, there were recommendations made in there in terms of how we could improve timeliness of fiscal notes. We do have data showing how many fiscal notes are completed within the expected time frame. I'm happy to share that with the committee.
Interested. I know that's why I say there's really kind of two questions from my perspective, and you were addressing the first question, and I target of opportunity to put my oar in again on the on the timeliness. But I would be interested in how that's improved. I'd also be interested in input from the committee chairs and what their experience has been when they were putting the omnibus bills together, if they could get the information they needed when they needed it.
Representative
Hausman, did you have your hand up?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up on a couple of the questions about the stakeholder issue. These, I'm assuming, must be your internal communication, the newsletter that we have?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, that's the newsletter that we share with the stakeholders, all those folks who have access, a login access to the system. We're happy to share those with this committee as well.
And Mr. Chair, so I guess the question is that definition of stakeholder. I think some people here assumed that maybe fiscal chairs were stakeholders, or but I think this is new to us. And what I notice here is there's a meeting Monday, December 9th of stakeholders. So I think from the questions here and the answers you gave, I think it's the definition of stakeholder that's confusing to me.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, we're happy to reach out as broadly as we can, and we will, if you'd like, put all of you on our email list for stakeholders. We have we've defined stakeholders to be those folks who are accessing the system. Clearly, you are stakeholders, and we will. You're welcome to attend the discussion. I'm happy to set up an alternative discussion as well if you find that those discussions are a little too detailed and technical for you. So I'm happy to facilitate feedback from all of you and in whatever way would be most useful.
Okay. We're now getting the information distributed, so why don't you continue that?
Okay.
They're handing them out now.
Thank you. I'm going to move on to the capital budget system, if you're ready.
I'm not starting. Thank you.
Our capital budget system is going to kick off. We are projecting to kick that off in January of 2014, so this coming January. Again, this will be a web-based system that will include capacity for local units of government to submit their requests online, as well as allow state agencies to submit their requests online. Currently, it is all in a Word document format that they download the form, they fill it out, and they mail it back to MMB. So we're looking for a web-based system to facilitate that data entry for local units of government. And again, we'll create a project team that will include agency and legislative staff representatives. And we hope for this system to go live in May of 2015 for the capital budget that will be put together for the 2016 legislative session.
Okay, any questions? That is kind of a new issue from my perspective, so I guess kind of bottom line, you're saying that the capital request will be online as opposed to pencil paper, is that?
The capital request will be submitted online. So the system is going to be a web-based system that will allow local units of government to do all of their data entry for their requests online. We will continue to publish the document that you get every summer and every fall.
Well, how do they submit it now? That's, I guess, where I'm not totally clear.
When they submit paper copies now, Mr.
Yeah,
Chair.
So it's pencil paper and it'll be done electronically.
Right, correct.
Should be faster, more efficient?
We're hoping so, Mr. Chair.
Okay. They're hoping so. Any questions? Oh, we're close to, you're done?
I just want to say we're on track, both budget-wise and process-wise, with our systems. We do risk analysis with minutes, and, of course, with every systems projects, there are some risks, and we're working to mitigate them. So we're hoping to have successful projects.
Okay. And just before we adjourn, Representative Hausman asked if I would give an update on Carol. Many of you know Carol, not everybody here, but my wife had... in October, knee surgery. She got a new knee. And this morning, we had to be up at 4 a.m. to get her to the hospital, and she had surgery very early in the morning. I've got new respect for these surgeons in terms of the hours that they work. But at any rate, she's got her second new knee, and the surgery went very well, and she's resting, and I've been in touch. The disruption of the phone call was that I didn't know how to turn my wife. I forgot, for one thing, that I even had my wife's phone in my pocket. About 5 this morning, she said, "Here, Lyndon, take my phone." And so I had to call upon Jean on how to turn her phone off. It's a technology I'm not totally familiar with. It's too simple a phone from the one that I'm used to. But at any rate, she's doing well. But it takes a couple weeks. She goes into rehab on Monday. 3 days in the hospital and then 2 weeks in rehab, and then it takes up to, I've learned a lot about knees, it takes up to about a year before all of the pain and discomfort goes away, although the majority of it goes away in about 6 weeks. So for those of you that know her, she's doing well. So with that, I'll say meeting adjourned, and thank you.
Thank you.